On this edition of Celebrating Science, Professor Michael Peskin on why the top quark is so elusive. Brought to you by Canada's Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics, an independent, nonprofit scientific research and education outreach organization, home to a growing cluster of international scientists who contemplate and calculate new ideas about the very essence of space, time, matter, and information. Perimeter Institute also offers a wide array of educational outreach activities for students, teachers, and members of the general public in order to share the joys of scientific research, discovery, and innovation. In this presentation, Top Quark, the Elusive Truth, Michael Peskin reviews our current understanding of the top quark and explains how experiments at giant particle accelerators have helped increase our knowledge. He also describes upcoming experiments which might reveal the top quark's deeper mysteries. Dr. Peskin received his doctorate in physics at Cornell University in 1978 and was elected to the American Academy of Arts and Sciences in 2000. With Daniel Schroeder, he authored the textbook An Introduction to Quantum Field Theory. Dr. Peskin is also known for his seminal contributions in the area of precision electroweak measurements.
The top quark, the subject of today's lecture, is the heaviest of the quarks that make up strongly interacting elementary particles. The two heaviest quarks are called top and bottom, but sometimes physicists call them truth and beauty. Now, the bottom quark, in my opinion, is not particularly beautiful. But the top quark, well, those of us who are really interested in this particle do believe that it's where we'll find truth. And that's what I'd like to tell you about this evening. The organizers kindly provided me with a meter stick, but actually they should have provided me with an attometer stick. An attometer is a millionth of a billionth of a meter. And that's where we're going. So this is obviously an atom. An atom you think of as a very small thing, but if you're a particle physicist, an atom is so big that it's hardly worth talking about in the realm of small. I'd like you to think of the atom as about as big as the Earth. And so then an atomic nucleus, the little thing in the center of the atom, would be about the size of a basketball court. And where we're going is the size of the basketball, okay? A factor of 100,000 and then another factor of 1,000 times smaller. One of the processes that we'll talk about today is radioactive decay, which is mediated by this thing, red thing here, called the W boson, a very heavy elementary particle, about 80 times heavier than the proton. And so let's talk a little about that to begin. So this is your picture of radioactive decay. Inside the atom, there's this tiny nucleus. It's a ball. It's made of protons and neutrons. One of the neutrons will decay. It will change itself into a proton. It will spit out some really tiny elementary particles, the electron and the antineutrino. Now, this is the way probably most people think about beta decay, but it's not the right way. And the reason for that is that a neutron or a proton is not itself an elementary object. Once again, we think of atoms as huge things that are beyond our consideration being too large. A proton is something like this, which is a big bag which contains these quarks and also the particles called gluons that bind them together. And when a neutron turns into a proton, what happens is that one of the quarks inside the neutron turns into another kind of quark that makes that bound state a proton instead. And so when we go down now to the atto scale, what we're looking at is something like this. A down-type quark turning into what we call an up-type quark and giving off, again, the electron and the antineutrino, two very small penetrating particles. And the reaction the particle that mediates this, that the down quark emits, and it lives for oh, I don't know how many billionths of a second. It lives for less time than it takes light to cross an atomic nucleus. That W boson bursts into existence, turns into these guys that I've drawn over here, and disappears forever. Now, if you're an aficionado of quarks, you've of course got to talk about this bottom or beauty quark that I talked about before. The beauty quark is also unstable, and its decay is basically the same kind of thing. The beauty quark, or the bottom quark, turns into another quark. Then you can ask me later where the names come from, called the charmed quark. It, again, flickers on one of these very heavy W bosons. The bottom quark weighs about 4 times the proton mass, so it doesn't actually have enough energy to make a whole W boson. But because of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, it can have that energy temporarily. But as I said, hardly long enough to even glimpse it, and then it turns into this. Now, what's very nice about the top quark is that for the top quark, this is all very different. The top quark, instead of being a mere 4 times the mass of the proton, is 170 times the mass of the proton. It's a huge, hulking quark. You shouldn't get the idea that the top quark is large. All these quarks are extremely tiny on this Addo scale compared to the nucleus, but in that tiny volume, there's a huge amount of mass. And maybe I should just put up front, one of the things we don't understand about the top quark is why it has so much mass compared to these others. We'll get to that point a little later. But the thing about the top quark is that it has enough mass to actually create one of these W bosons and just let it stay there. And so the top quark decays to a bottom quark and a W boson that just kind of sits around for a while and decays then in its normal lifetime instead of just disappearing. The normal lifetime of the W boson is still not very long. It's maybe the time it takes light to cross a couple atomic nuclei. But nevertheless, it exists for a while as a distinct particle, and it allows us to study the top quark in a very beautiful way. And so now maybe I can explain to you what top quarks actually look like. And then after that, I want to try and explain to you how we know that top quarks exist. How, if you were a top quark hunter, you would go looking for top quarks, and how the real top quark hunters actually find them. So here's now the reaction that I described. The top quark turns into a bottom quark and a W boson. The W boson hangs around for its natural life, very short compared to that of a mouse or a butterfly. And then it'll turn into one of two things, either the electron and the neutrino, or some kind of heavy electron and its neutrino, or a quark and an antiquark. We end up with either three quarks, or a quark, an electron, or maybe a muon, and an invisible neutrino. And so you could imagine that you could build a high-energy physics experiment, get these high-energy beams colliding with each other, get enough energy together so that you can get 170 times the proton mass in some little space, actually make this thing, and prove that it exists by observing these particles come out in the pattern that you expect. And so for the next roughly 20 minutes, I'm going to try and expand on that point of view. How do we actually do that? What do we look for? And how do we actually know that top quarks are being produced? To begin, we need to answer this question. What does a quark actually look like? The electron, you know what that looks like. It is a path in a cloud chamber or a dot on your cathode ray tube or your television set. A quark is something else. Quarks, those of you who know a little about quarks know that they have one-third or two-thirds charges. And we've never seen an isolated one-third or two-thirds charges. So quarks are always bound up inside strongly interacting particles. But fortunately, if you put a really large amount of energy into the process of producing a quark, you can get it to look like something very characteristic. And one way to do that, a very nice way, is to take electrons and have them accelerated in an accelerator, take anti-electrons, positrons, the antiparticles of electrons. When you bring together an electron and its antiparticle, they annihilate into a burst of energy, which can then materialize into any kind of particle, including quarks. Now, what you really want to do is accelerate those electrons and positrons to very high energy and bring them together. And then you get very energetic elementary particles. So this is something that we do at SLAC, the place where I'm from. We have a 3-kilometer-long linear accelerator, which is diagrammed here. So the electrons start up there, and they get accelerated down the linear accelerator. When the experiments I'll describe were done, the electrons would get 50 billion volts worth of energy coming down that accelerator. So here's a diagram of the apparatus. This is my friend Marty Breidenbach at SLAC who designed it. Basically, it's layers of stuff that allow you to image the reaction. The simplest thing that can happen is the electron and positron scatter from one another and go off as an electron and positron. This thing takes a beautiful picture of that. So you see the straight tracks made by the electron and positron, and then there are some devices here that measure the energy of the electron and positron, and that's visualized here by the height of the towers that you see. Okay, well now what happens if the electron and positron come together and make quarks? Well, you might think that the quarks would then interact strongly with one another because they're the basic particles of the strong interactions. They would make lots of elementary particles and they would boil off in all directions. But that's actually not what happens. What happens is that you get events that look like this. So this is a kind of amazing thing. This is some 10 pions, the lightest kind of strongly interacting particle, very, very simple, very round. But you get a stream of them that all move in the same direction in a very collimated way. We call this a jet. And what you see are two jets, which are back to back. And there's a lot of evidence, I'll show you some a little later in the lecture, that what's actually going on here is that you've made a quark and an antiquark. These guys go apart from one another. They basically rip apart space because they're strongly interacting just between themselves. They make lots more quarks and antiquarks, and they form these streams of particles that go outward. And so from the point of view of an experimental physicist, this is what a quark looks like. You look for a jet of particles, highly collimated like that, cast out at some very high momentum, and that is very likely to be a quark. Now, unfortunately, 50 billion volts plus 50 billion volts is only 100 billion volts. And with that, you can only make a particle that's 100 times the mass of the proton. So we didn't make this thing long enough to be able to produce top quarks. So to get to the top quarks, we have to go to some very different place, namely Illinois. So in Illinois, there's a laboratory called Fermilab that instead of, as we do, accelerating electrons and positrons, accelerates protons and the antiparticles of protons, antiprotons. And roughly, you have a large accelerator here that accelerates the protons. Just as I told you with electrons and positrons, you take the protons off, you shoot them at a target, which is located around here somewhere. The target is made of liquid metal, because if it were made of solid metal, as soon as you hit it with the beam, it would be liquid metal, so you might as well start there. You gather up the antiprotons, you put them back in here as kind of the refrigerator, and then you dump them into another ring here where they circulate literally for about a day. The protons going one way, the antiprotons going the other way, and they collide in specific places. And so this red building here houses a large piece of equipment called CDF. The gray building here houses another large piece of equipment called D0. Now, when I show you data, I'm going to show you data from both CDF and D0. But to make it simple, I'm going to talk as if everything came from CDF. Now, needless to say, there are about 600 physicists who build each of these detectors, and they're incredibly competitive with each other. There's a group in Toronto, which is one of the very important groups in CDF, but I don't know anyone in this part of Canada who works on D0. So I'm just going to pretend that it all came from CDF, except that when a D0 result comes, you'll see D0 on the slides. In any case, this is what CDF looks like. It's a several-story high piece of apparatus. It's just like the SLD detector that I showed you before. The protons and antiprotons come in along this axis like that. Then there are all kinds of devices that image the reaction and tell you about different properties of it. I should show you some pictures of top quarks. And eventually we will get there, but there are a few things to discuss first. First of all is this unfortunate fact of doing physics with protons. Each time the protons go around and collide the antiprotons, the probability that something happens that you could record with this detector is 1. The probability that top quarks are produced is 1 in 10 billion. And so you have to look very carefully and be very sure that you're not making a mistake if you try and identify something as the top quark. And this mistake has been made, so one must be especially careful. Okay, so what do top quarks look like? Well, the first thing we should do is look at some proton-antiproton collider events. So I showed you some electron-positron collider events. Now, here is a typical proton-antiproton collider event. There are a lot of tracks. And the question is something interesting going on in this event or not? Well, needless to say, you can't discern that by looking at this picture. You have to do some more detailed analysis. Here's a nice way to visualize it. Let's say here's the detector, and some particles are coming out. What I'd like to do is unroll this picture in a certain way. So I'm going to cut it over here, and I'm going to unroll it onto a plane. So when I go around, that corresponds to going across in this direction. Forward will be to this end. Backward will be to this end. Then remember, I'm looking for these jets, which are things that go out with great impulse. So I'm going to take roughly the energy of a track. More precisely, the energy of the track projected transverse to the direction of the incoming beams. And I'm going to put that at the correct angle as a tower. So the not-so-energetic particles will be small towers, and the very energetic particles will be large towers. And high-energy physicists refer to this as a Lego plot, because when you actually draw these things in three dimensions, it looks like a pile of Lego. So each of those tracks you saw is some little tower on this plot. Sometimes when the tracks get close together, they merge into a single tower. But now you see this event is totally wimpy, because we put in protons and antiprotons that had the energy of 1,000 GeV each, and the highest towers are only about 5 times the proton mass. We put in 1,000, we got out 5. That's not interesting. Here's another event. Let me just go back and show you this one. And then I'll show you another event that looks superficially exactly like the one I showed you before. But if you draw it on the Lego plot, it looks dramatically different. So now what's happened is that a lot of those tracks, the tracks with low energy now become invisible. The tracks with high energy form two collimated bundles, the jets. And actually, the energy here is now almost 400 GeV, 400 times the proton mass. So now, something really impressive has happened. A quark from the proton has hit a quark from the antiproton, and they scattered out at large angle. And each of them, the quark and the antiquark, produced one of those towers. So this is something truly impressive. But now, the thing that I don't know if it depresses you, but it depresses me. This event is also totally uninteresting, because this is just ordinary quarks hitting other ordinary quarks, and it's not the top quark yet. But now at least we're on the right track. So now we throw away all of these guys too, And now you get a lot of your factors that you need to get to find something that's 1 in 10 billion. And so now let's think a little more about what a top quark event actually looks like. So we're going to look for events that look like this. We make a top quark with its antiparticle, the anti-top quark. The top quark decays to a B and a W, which then the W decays to two quarks, or a quark and an antiquark. The anti-top quark decays to an anti-B and an anti-W, because it's symmetric that way. And this anti-W might decay to an electron and the neutrino. And so now we can look for events with not only two things with large impulse, but actually five things with large impulse. Namely, two bottom quarks, two ordinary quarks, the electron, and the neutrino will also come out at large impulse. So that'll mean that some momentum in the event is missing, so the event will be visibly unbalanced. And that's a pretty interesting thing to look for. So now there's only one more question that I have to answer for you, and that is, what does a bottom quark look like? How do I tell that from an ordinary quark when these things are so small that I can't really see them in the first place? Well, there's a trick for that. And that is that whereas ordinary quarks, even the ones that decay by beta decay, like the down quark turning into the up quark, live quite a long time, bottom quarks live a shorter time, but it's a short time that's macroscopic. Bottom quarks live 1.5 picoseconds, 1.5 billionths of a second. Now, that seems like a short time, but actually it's an eternity, because I told you we think about time like the time it takes light to cross an atomic nucleus. And if you're traveling at the speed of light, a picosecond will get you a whole half a millimeter. And so if you think about one of these detectors that's four stories high, you might think it's challenging to measure a distance of half a millimeter. But if you're a very good experimenter, you can do it. Not me, but my friends can do that. And so what I'd like to do now is to take this picture that came from the SLD experiment and magnify it. Because it turns out that in the center of this four-story high thing, there's a device about this big that has silicon wafers in it, actually CCDs, so you get two-dimensional pictures. And it takes pictures of the tracks very close in. Here is the first magnification. So now you see these silicon wafers. And where the track passes through the silicon wafer, it leaves a black dot on your picture, and then you can read it out. And by finding out where those dots are and extrapolating back, you can track the tracks way into the interior. And now if we get to the sub-centimeter scale, I'll blow this up again. You see the tracks don't all come from the center. Some tracks come from here, but there are other tracks that come from here, and there are other tracks that come from here. And those distances are a few millimeters. So it turned out that in this event, some bottom quarks, or rather their mesons, were born here. And one of them traveled to here and decayed, and the other one traveled over here and decayed. And please notice that it's all lined up with the jets. So those were the original things that were born to make the jets. And then various pions and other stuff accompany them. So in CDF, they do the same thing. Here's the silicon tracker. Here's the way the silicon tracker looks to a CDF experimenter. Actually, this guy, David Stewart, is now a professor in Santa Barbara, so he must have put the thing together right. Look at this event. So there it is. It's exactly what I was telling you. This thing here is identified as an electron. Now I've removed all the low energy tracks, so I only see the very high energy tracks. You see that there are 1, 2, 3, 4 bundles of them. And then it's marked in red here. These tracks and these tracks come from places that are visibly displaced from the place where the proton and antiproton collided. So it's exactly what you would expect. Three of these are a top quark. Three of these are an anti-top quark. Here's another such picture. Let me again take you through this. So here is the Lego plot. You see one, two, there are actually two jets on top of each other here, which you would see if the thing were a little larger. Here are the very energetic tracks. You see four of these jets, four quarks. If you blow up this region once and then twice, as I did before, you see that the red tracks come from places that are displaced by millimeters from the original interaction vertex. And so it's exactly the signature we're talking about. And then there is an electron identified. And then if you add up the momenta, it's actually unbalanced. So there's a neutrino as well. And from the other side of the ring, from D0, this is apparently an event where you have six jets. Two of the jets are identified in another way as having bottom quarks in them. And so this is one where the W's decayed to quarks on both sides of the event. Now, if you're you, you'd probably be satisfied. But if you're an elementary particle physicist, you probably wouldn't, because you'd be worried about that 10 billion thing. If something only happens once in 10 billion, nature can surely find a way to make it happen. And for top quarks, there's a way it could actually happen. It turns out that if a quark and an antiquark annihilate, they can make one of these W bosons. And on the way in, they can radiate photons, but they could also radiate the thing that holds the quarks together, the gluon. And the gluon very often turns into a pair of a bottom quark and an anti-bottom quark. And so this makes exactly the same thing that I told you before. The W makes an electron in the neutrino. I have two bottom quarks. If on the way in I radiate two more gluons, then I can make exactly the kinds of events that I just showed you without having any top quarks. And so you have to rule this out. Here, then, is the really compelling evidence. If you have a W boson, an electron and a neutrino, with one jet, that gives this measured rate. And then you can model that process using the data that I just showed you. And it turns out that you can explain the whole thing. So all the green stuff here is actually the expected rate for a W plus one jet. The blue stuff is other kinds of reactions that can fake this. You see it's relatively unimportant. Now, what if you have a W plus two jets? Well, it turns out that the just ordinary W's model that precisely as well. Now, what if you have a W plus three jets? Well, you use the same model. It's very easy to extrapolate. Your data tells you how to do that, but you only get this puny amount, and four jets and five jets. And the measured rates are up here. So as you go to more and more jets, you need some other process other than just the ordinary production of W and radiation of gluons to tell you that something that has to be happening there. And that is the top quark. So having understood basically this half of the diagram, we now got to the 1 in 10 million level, 1 in 10 billion level. And we can actually confidently say the confusion here is very small. There's something left over. We really did discover another quark. There are other ways to do it. The top and W events look different in various ways. Top is heavier, so the jets are more energetic. There are generally more of them. They fly around all over the place more. This is a particular variable that distinguishes them. The CDF people looked at lots of these variables, lots more. Eventually, they argued that you could explain all of the W plus three jets in this model, but when you use that model to predict W plus four jets, you only got the amount of stuff that's shown here in red, whereas the measured numbers are what's shown by the black points. So once again, there's some new process involving a very heavy particle, which then must be the top quark. So now, hopefully, I've convinced you that the top quark exists. So now the next problem is, when you get these top quarks, what do you do with them? Now, the top quarks live in the quantum world. And so then you have to use a logic which makes essential use of quantum mechanics in order to figure out how you take these top quarks and learn something from them. And that's something I like to call quantum patterns. So now I'd like to tell you a little about what quantum patterns are. And then when we understand this notion, we'll apply it to the top quark. So the place to start is by thinking about angular momentum. Angular momentum is the tendency of a spinning object to remain spinning. It's something that you all know about. It's why a bicycle stays up. It's why, I don't know if you've ever seen people play with bicycle wheels. When you turn them over, you get contorted and it makes you twist around like that. Angular momentum is a very essential property of all scales in nature. I mean, it determines basically the spiral structure of galaxies. But it's also incredibly important for elementary particles. And that's because elementary particles contain intrinsic angular momentum. So I told you that the electrons and the quarks are extremely small. They're atometer size. But nevertheless, they're spinning in there. And they can actually transfer that angular momentum to other particles and, if you like, flip over and spin in the opposite direction. And so let's talk a little about the spin of elementary particles like electrons. Now, in quantum mechanics, spin is very weird. And for example, if you have an electron, the electron has two states of spin. Up and down. You would think that an electron had an infinite number of states of spin because it was spinning like this. You could twist it so it's spinning in any direction. But actually, there are only two, up and down. A very beautiful and very counterintuitive proof of that was done by Stern and Gerlach in this experiment, 1922, before actually the formal invention of quantum mechanics. They took silver atoms, which had an extra electron, so that electron had its spin. They put it through an inhomogeneous magnetic field, so it's something that if the spin was up, it would bend it up. If the spin was down, it would bend it down. If the spin was in some intermediate position, it wouldn't bend it at all. And what they expected was that the silver atoms would display the various spins and form a big blotch on that screen. Just to show you what this looks like, here's a modern version of the experiment. But the thing I really want to show you is what the blotch looks like. So it looks like this. It's extremely odd. When you train to be a physicist, they have you go in the laboratory and do these experiments. And it really, it's mind-reeling to see this thing appear. But it's true. The electron can be spin up or it can be spin down, just these two states. Okay, so gradually, if people give you enough lectures about quantum mechanics, and probably you've heard a lot of them, you're used to this notion. So now let's take it to the next level. What if you have two Stern-Gerlach, and I meant to just say this. The spin of an elementary particle is the key to its identity. So an electron has spin a half. These two states are an essential part of the electron's property. The quark is a spin a half. The particles that we normally associate with forces, photons and gluons, it turns out have spin one. The W also spin one unit. And the graviton spin 2, which makes it an especially tricky particle to understand. But I'll leave that to Lee. That's not my department. Okay, so now let's take Stern and Gerlach to the next level. What if we have not one Stern-Gerlach experiment, but two Stern-Gerlach experiments, one after another? So I take the beam of electrons that comes in, it gets split by this magnet. One part goes up, one part goes down. now I really try and find out, well, what happened? There are two states, but the electron can have an arbitrary orientation, I should think. So what happens if I now put it through a system which is rotated by some angle? Then I'm trying to find out whether the electron is spin up or spin down along this axis. And the odd thing is, there are still two outcomes. And the number of electrons that go up versus the number of electrons that go down depends on the angle with which the first axis measures it at this angle, the next one at that angle. That ratio depends on the angle. Obviously, if you do the same experiment twice, the second time all the electrons go up. But if you start increasing the angle, not all of the electrons go up, some of them go down. It turns out that this ratio is described by an extremely simple function, which is what I call the quantum pattern. And it depends on what the magnitude of the spin is. For spin a half, it's a linear relation like that. All the electrons go up when you're at this orientation. When you're at 90 degrees, half of them go up. And a smooth linear function in between. That's true for electrons. If you have particles with higher spin, like the W boson, for example, you get a different function. Electron, W boson. OK. So, of course, we don't take these Stern-Gerlach magnets and try and do experiments on W bosons. But nevertheless, we can recognize these patterns in elementary particle reactions. I emphasize to you that these patterns are very simple mathematical functions. They're prescribed by the laws of quantum mechanics. So now you do experiments and you go look for them. And now let me give you one example where that occurs. So here's a reaction that I showed you before. These are labeled with mu, but they could as well be labeled with quarks. The electron and positron come together. They make some cloud of energy when they annihilate. And that reappears as two electrons or two quarks, or two muons for that matter. And then the electrons can come out in their original directions, but very probably they'll come out at some angle. And that angle can actually play the role of the angle between two of these spin discrimination experiments, Stern-Gerlach experiments that I told you about before. Now the electron is spin a half, and the positron is spin a half. And they actually annihilate in such a way that the composite blob of energy has spin one. A half plus a half, so a double quantum of angular momentum. And then in that case, actually, this is the distribution that applies, and you can put the whole story together. So the probability of the collision depends on the angle. Well, basically, like this factor, if the electron originally was spinning, I've got to put that down, the electron was spinning this way and the positron was spinning this way, or that factor, if the electron came in spinning this way and it annihilated a positron spinning that way. And the other two possibilities, you don't get anything. So those are the two possibilities. And you get a nice curve that looks like that. So the probability for the quark jets is very large in the forward direction, lower but non-zero at 90 degrees, and very large in the backward direction. OK, well, now you go take these pictures. You figure out at what orientation the jets are, and you plot them up, and you see if the nature looks like that. And lo and behold, nature looks like that. This is data from another experiment similar to the SLD. They published a prettier picture. But you see that blue curve there? And then that's what the real data from nature looks like. So these elementary particle reactions know about these special simple functions that come from quantum mechanics. And we can try and use that information in order to look inside elementary particle collisions and figure out what's going on there. OK, so You ready? Now we'll do this for the top quark. Okay, well now, a top quark is a quark, so it has spin 1/2. And I'd like you to think about the top quark spinning in this direction. That is, that's the axis, and it's spinning around like that. The bottom quark is also a spin 1/2 particle. Now, it turns out to be a property of the weak interactions that whenever a fast quark is emitted from a weak interaction, like beta decay, the electrons emitted in radioactive decay, it always spins in the left-handed sense. Don't ask me why. If it were an anti-quark, it would spin in the right-handed sense. So it somehow all balances out. This is a fact about weak interactions, which it's a true fact. I can give another lecture and explain to you how we know, but we know. The W boson is a spin 1 particle, so it actually has 3 ways to spin, right-handed, left-handed, and kind of in the middle, which I call W0. Now, the total angular momentum of the top quark is 1/2 unit. So there are only 2 ways to make these add up. Either the bottom quark goes backwards with a left-handed spin, and the W is kind of in the middle, or the bottom quark goes forward with a backward spin, and then the W with its twice as long spin goes backwards. And these are 2 distinct processes, this one and that one. And we can actually try and separate them using angles and using these quantum patterns, because each of those processes has its own quantum pattern. First of all, the orientation here, it's not always forward. It's a quantum pattern. It's one of these 1 plus cosine of the angle and 1 minus cosine of the angle. So we know, quantum mechanics tells us, the distribution of where the W and B are going to go. And further, when the W decays, the decay distribution is given by another quantum pattern associated with the spin 1. So the For example, the quark and the antiquark are aligned with this axis, very much like the quark and the antiquark were aligned with the axis when I annihilated electrons and made spin 1 that way. On the other hand, the W that's spinning like in the middle will send off the quark and antiquark at right angles to its path. And so you can look for the W decays, something at right angles is likely to be this kind of W. Something that's going forward and backward is likely to be this kind of W. If you have these events, if you've seen the 4 quarks, the electron, the missing stuff, so you can tell where the neutrino went, you can put everything together and you can measure these angles. And so people do that. And here is actually a measurement of those angles. And it's kind of interesting, because most of the data is in the center. There's some enhancement over on this side, and not much on that side. And let me give you a better picture of the theory, and then we'll go back to the data. So here's this angle I was telling you about, the W and the angle at which the quark and antiquark go off. The W0 produces a big lump in the center. So this is a function defined by the laws of quantum mechanics. The left-handed W produces a lopsided distribution like that. There isn't supposed to be any right-handed because of conservation of angular momentum. And the whole thing adds up to this curve, which, if you look back now, to within the limited accuracy of the experiment, looks pretty much like what we measure at Fermilab. OK. Well, now maybe we're understanding something, except there's still something which is a little odd, which is that mostly it's the intermediate W, the one that's not spinning either left-handed or right-handed, but which is at the intermediate position, that really dominates the picture. And we would like to know why that is. And it turns out that the explanation for that is profound. So let me try to explain it to you in 5 minutes. If you're a particle physicist, you probably accept the fact that the W has three polarization states because it's part of the laws of quantum mechanics. But if you think deeply about it, then the harder you think about it, the weirder it gets. Because the W is something that carries a force. It's really pretty much like the photon, the particle that carries the electromagnetic force. But photons actually only have two polarization states, not three. A photon can be, those of you who do photography know this, it can be linearly polarized along one of two axes, or it can be, people say, circularly polarized. But there are only two choices, and there aren't three. And once again, those of you who do photography, you put lenses, because light from the sky is polarized, so you can put a lens to make the sky darker and improve your picture like that. When you put two of these lenses together, they cancel each other out. So here are these linear polarizers. There'll be an axis like that. If you put together two linear polarizers with the same axis, it has hardly any effect. If you put them crossed, it blocks all the light. Not two-thirds of the light, all the light. So why doesn't this work for a W boson, if a W boson is supposed to be more or less the same thing as a photon? Well, here's a picture that tries to explain that. So this is actually what a photon looks like inside, if you like. A photon has electromagnetic forces in it, electromagnetic fields. It has an electric field that points this way. If it's moving this way, it has an electric field pointing this way and a magnetic field pointing that way. For linear polarization, the electric field always points in the same direction, and the magnetic field wiggles back and forth. For a circular polarization, there's actually the electric field rotates in the right-handed sense, if it's a right-handed angular momentum, and in the left-handed sense, if it's left-handed angular momentum. But either way, that model says there are only two possibilities. Oh, we could try and rotate it around, but remember, photons move at the speed of light. So you can't actually stop the photon and turn it around so it has a different orientation. Something going at the speed of light, you just have to let it go there. And so the only possibilities we can have is that the E and B rotate around this way as it goes at the speed of light, or they rotate around that way. There aren't any other choices. Now, for a W boson, there are other choices. Because a W boson is a heavy thing, we could stop it, or we could run as fast as a W boson and see it at rest. And the W boson at rest, we could just rotate into any configuration, this way, or around that way. And so we can make any one of the three possible polarization states, not just two. And now I'd like to remind you that, you can make this sound trivial, but it's actually profound. The presence of the third polarization state goes together one-to-one with the fact that the W has mass, whereas the photon is massless. And if you want to understand how the W got to be 80 times heavier than the proton, while the photon doesn't weigh anything at all, then one way to attack that problem is to figure out where this extra state came from, so that there are three instead of two. So various theoretical physicists, Sheldon Glashow probably is the name I should mention here, built a model where the photon and the W boson are three facets of the same thing. You have the W plus, the W minus, and the photon, and they correspond to three directions in a certain abstract space. So there's perfect symmetry among those three particles. And in that theory, they're all massless. None of them has any mass. And it's perfectly symmetric. You have three different particles which are all identical to one another, and they all zoom around at the speed of light. And because of the logic I just gave you, they all have exactly two states of polarization. But then, he said, what if something would come and destroy the beautiful symmetry of this space? Some mysterious thing that would tell me that this is the right direction and not that one. And maybe I should say, in this model, the photon actually corresponds to a rotation about this axis. So if I put something here, these rotations are still very good symmetries of the diagram, but these rotations get frozen out. And so let me draw you that diagram. Okay? And then the photon stays massless and totally symmetric and with two polarization states, and the W plus and minus get very heavy masses. And this thing, which frankly particle physicists still don't really understand what it is, but nevertheless, if we can draw the diagram, we can give it a name. That thing is called the Higgs field. And if you think about now the Higgs field in a quantum system, in quantum mechanics, it'll jiggle around in various directions at different places in space. This way, or this way. The jiggling around this way, when you quantize it, that's a particle. And it turns out that the W minus eats up that particle, and that particle becomes the magic third state of the W minus. The wiggling this way is another particle eaten by the W plus, and that becomes the necessary third state of the W plus. And then the wiggling this way is some massive extra particle, and that's the particle called the Higgs boson, which, as you probably know, people like me would really like to find, but we haven't been able to, but we think it's out there somewhere. Now we've got a clue. Because the thing that was eaten became not the left-handed polarization state of the W, not the right-handed one, but the one in between. And I just told you that that's the state that seems to be produced most copiously in top quark decays. And in the model with the Higgs boson and this Higgs field, the reason for that is that the top quark is heavy. Because the mass of the top quark is also supposed to come from the Higgs field, and that means that the top quark is very strongly coupled to this Higgs field, and therefore to the things that are eaten by the W's when they get mass. And so exactly the fact that most of the time the top quark decays to this intermediate spin state of the W is supposed to be correlated with the fact that the top quark is heavy and gets its mass from the Higgs field just as the W does. I showed you the data isn't very good on this. It's indicative. But by trying to produce many more top quarks, by studying the details of the story in much greater detail, this is a window onto the Higgs field to try and figure out whether the story I've told you is really true in every detail or not. So now the final chapter, how do we get more top quarks and figure out really what's going on? Well, now, of course, we're all looking forward, those of us in elementary particle physics, to this big machine in Geneva called the Large Hadron Collider at CERN. It's a truly mammoth machine, 27 kilometers in circumference. It will accelerate protons to 7,000 times the proton mass, an eventual energy of 14,000 times, all available to make weird elementary particles of every description. And it's especially good for making top quarks. And the reason is shown here. At the Tevatron, we only get 2,000 times the proton mass. The proton is a big bag of quarks and these gluons. Generally, only the very most energetic quarks inside the proton have enough energy to annihilate on the very most energetic antiquarks inside the antiproton to produce a top quark and an anti-top quark. The gluons don't have enough energy to do that because the protons aren't moving very fast, just as fast as we could make protons move up until very recently. At the Large Hadron Collider, we'll get each of these guys going with 7 times more energy. So now the gluons will be very energetic. And there are lots of gluons in a proton. I mean, you can think of a high-energy proton as like a flashlight for gluons. And the gluon pairs have enough energy to produce top quarks. And when they have enough energy, they have a very high probability of doing that. So at the Tevatron, we'll get 10,000 top quarks by the time we're done. At the LHC, we hope to get 10 million top quarks. And now we can really start doing precision experiments on these very weird and exotic objects. This is the experiment that my colleagues at SLAC and also your neighbors in Toronto are involved in, called ATLAS. It looks just like the SLD, as you see, a big round detector, very large, that images elementary particle reactions. These are people, though. These things get larger and larger. This is 10 stories high. On the other side of the ring, our competitors are called CMS. They're called compact because their detector is only 5 stories high. You notice that it's built from rings. So each of these things is like the shape of a tuna can. And you would think that you stack them like this to make the detector. Actually, it was built in a warehouse on the surface, and then they lower it 100 meters to the LHC tunnel underground. And here are just some pictures of the CMS detector being assembled down there. So eventually you get this beautiful stacked up arrangement that makes the particle detector that I show here. And just in the past couple weeks, there's new news from the LHC. On November 23rd, a week ago Monday, the first collisions were observed by ATLAS and CMS. And here are the pictures from ATLAS and from CMS. So now you know how to read these pictures. Elementary particles are colliding. If you made the Lego plots, you'd think it was totally wimpy. But we'll get there. These are just the first ones. On November 30th, the energy was raised to 2.36 TeV. So this is now officially the highest energy accelerator in the world. Gradually, we'll raise the energy, raise the intensity, get, as I said, millions of these top quarks, and really try and learn all the details of their quantum structure that I was talking about in this lecture. So thank you very much.
This edition of Celebrating Science has been made possible by Canada's Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics through the support of private and public funding partners, including the Government of Canada and the Government of Ontario. To learn more about the Institute and enjoy other programs, visit us online at perimeterinstitute.ca.